Did you always want to be in HR?
So watching the Cosbys and being an articulate Black woman, I just wanted to be Claire Huxtable. And when I left college, I went to go take the LSAT. When I left Bennett, I went back home to Jersey. And I couldn't pass that test to save my life.
What is human resources?
Human resources is the function that helps with all of the people stuff. From hiring to exit, we do everything from designing the system to enter the person into the workforce. We are taught to grow up, get good grades, get a good job, to make money. But we're not taught to figure out what's your purpose? What do you do well? How can you make money? And I think that's why you see a lot of us who've been in this corporate space say, okay, we got to the echelon. We made it to the mountaintop and there's nothing here. So what do we do instead of this? That I would believe that most American companies are like bad boyfriends. I don't want you seeing nobody else, girl, you mine. Right, like it's very possessive. And then when the company doesn't get when you don't get what you want out of the company and you leave, the company's mad. Don't ever come back then. A lot of times managers will draft a job description or a rec for a unicorn. And what they really can afford is a pony, right? So they're looking for you to have stardust and sprinkles and all this stuff. But not only can they only afford the pony, but they can probably only manage.
Welcome back to episode 169 of the Textual Talk Podcast. I'm your host, HD, and today's guest is an HR expert with over 20 years of experience. Her name is Natalie Parker. She's the founder of Natalie Parker Enterprises and the host of the podcast, So Your Boss Sucks, Now What? In today's episode, we'll be discussing what has Natalie encountered over her 20 years of experience, how she went from wanting to be a lawyer to getting into HR, and the difficulties of hiring and firing employees in corporate America. Natalie's going to show us a couple of things that will help you stand out in your job search process and what she likes the most about HR and what is the specialty of her company, Natalie Parker Enterprises. As an added bonus, we'll also talk about being parents of neurodiverse children and the epidemic of Black men aren't going to college as much as they used to. Whether you're interested in law, HR, or all the above, this should be a thrilling episode for you to enjoy. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. This video will be sponsored by SNHU. So it's 2025 and cybersecurity is still all the rage. Breaches are at an all-time high and so are cyber salaries. But there's a problem you keep running into. Cyber jobs you want to land are requiring a degree and you don't have one. Let me introduce you to today's sponsor, Southern New Hampshire University, SNHU. SNHU has a flexible online program that also touts one of the lowest tuitions in the country. SNHU is an affordable, accredited, nonprofit university that has dedicated career advisors, webinars, internships, and more to prepare you to enter or advance in the workforce. There's a 32% projected growth of information security analyst roles through 2032, and according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the median security analyst salary in 2023 was $120,000. In SNHU's program, you can learn about these critical subjects: cybersecurity foundations, networking, incident response, risk management, enterprise security, and more. As a cybersecurity professional, these are all important courses. If you would like to know more about SNHU's program, then please visit snhu.edu/textual or click the link below in the description. Welcome back to the Textual Talk Podcast. I'm your host, HD. And we got another guest for you guys. Her name is Natalie Parker, and she came to kick it with us today. But first things first, if you're in the video so far and you like what you've seen, hit the like button, subscribe, hit the bell icon to be notified when we're dropping all content. And if you're listening right now, any podcast player, download the show, follow the show, leave us a review. It'll help us out in the podcast analytics. But guys, technically this is part two of our conversation. We technically had a show. We just didn't record it before. And I'm just going to give Natalie the floor to tell her truth. Natalie, how you doing today?
I'm good. How are you? Thanks for having me.
I'm doing well. So could you introduce our listeners to who you are?
Sure. Natalie Renee Parker, Jersey girl turned Southern Belle, originally from Jersey, went to school at the Bennett College in Greensboro, North Carolina, graduated, left there, went back home. I've worked in a myriad of industries. I actually started in procurement before I got into HR, but I've worked in defense and transportation and forestry and tech and in finance. And in all of my 20 plus years of HR, I decided to quit corporate So I'm a corporate quitter and started my business, Natalie Parker Enterprises. It'll be 3 years old in June and super excited about it. And one of the things that we do with the company is we're really focused on helping the dynamic between employees and their employers. We really think about the relationship. It shouldn't be transactional. It doesn't have to be transactional. The benefit of the company shouldn't have to come at the expense of the individual. And so we really try to bridge the gap between the company's ROI and the purpose of the individual, knowing that 50% of Americans have some kind of side hustle. Just think about that. So people are doing work outside of work. So how do we help make sure that people are thriving, even if it's tangential to the corporate initiatives, while making sure that the company can make its money? And we're really about organizational health and well-being. And so we do everything from organizational strategy to facilitation to leadership coaching and the like. And it's been amazing. We've had some really great big clients, and we've also had some startups that we've helped design their culture from the ground up, and they've seen the benefit of what we do. And as of recently, we started a podcast called So Your Boss Sucks, Now What? And if you think about the reason why we started the podcast, HD, it's because if we understand that Gallup says that 75% of people leave their manager and 85% of the workforce globally is disengaged, if those two things are true, and we know that companies spend $3.5 billion annually on leadership training, then how do we help the workforce knowing that they're already going to have a bad leader? Like in a 20-year career, you're going to work for at least 10 or 15 people, and you're going to like less than half of those. Like that relationship's not going to be good. And so how do we help people with the inevitable fact that they're probably going to work with somebody that they don't like, or they don't like, doesn't like them, or some dynamic that makes it hard to work for them? And we started the podcast to help shape and help people understand and get what they need in bad situations, because I've lived all of them. And so that's me in a nutshell. I'm a wife. I'm a mom. I've got two kids. And I'm also a minister, recently licensed, which is pretty cool. So we have a multiplicity of experiences and skills and background. That's us in a nutshell.
Perfect. Yeah. So guys, as you can see, I don't have to prime her or nothing. She's going to give it to you all. So I know you say you're the Jersey girl, and then turn Southern Belle. Briefly, because I actually got this for my combo, but did you always want to be in HR?
No. So I am a product of the Cosby generation of Thursday night at 8 o'clock. We all sat around the TV because we only have 3 or 4 channels, right? ABC, NBC, CBS, and PBS, 4 channels. God, I'm old. But so watching the Cosbys and being an articulate Black woman, I just wanted to be Claire Huxtable. You couldn't tell me anything different. I was going to go to Howard University. I was going to get my law degree, and I was going to be a lawyer out in these streets. And when I left college, I went to go take the LSAT. When I left Bennett, I went back home to Jersey. And I couldn't pass that test to save my life. And in that moment, I had the biggest existentialist crisis, because I'm like, what am I going to do? Because this has been the thing that I've wanted to do forever. I had a degree in English. I know I didn't want to study dead poets for the rest of my life. And it was rough. And it took me a good, I'd say 5 years to settle in to, okay, I like people. I like training. I like doing these things. And it was a really weird path to going back from interning to Lockheed to my HR person saying, hey, listen, you know all these systems, you need benefits, and we need a body, so come do this. And I did procurement for 2 years. And in 2 years, I realized, oh, I don't want to buy parts for the rest of my life. So what do I do? I was able to start training people on some of the tools and systems. I got green belt and black belt certified and realized I liked the development people part, and was able to parlay that through a series of long challenges into an HR career. And I've enjoyed it. Now, granted, I don't like the hiring, firing. Like, I don't do talent acquisition. I can do all of those things. I can do all of the things in HR. I just don't like all of them. Like the employee relations stuff, don't love doing that. I don't love talent acquisition. That's not my gifting. My gifting is the systems of people and creating leadership systems and people systems to help make sure the work gets done and the people are enjoying it and they're skilled to do what they do.
Okay. real quick, because you said something that I haven't heard. I've heard it. I mean, I've seen it on LinkedIn a while. You said green belt and black belt. That is that supply chain stuff, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. Lean Six Sigma, Kaizen, all of these things were an amalgamation of a bunch of different process management. So when you think of doing something, how do you do it in the most efficient way? And back in the early 2000s, late 90s, early 2000s, there was a really mass wave of training around lean manufacturing. So if you think about Henry Ford doing the assembly line, we're building the thing, the same thing over and over again, and it's the most efficient way. And lean manufacturing, it's how do you do it with the least amount of steps, the least amount of waves, what have you. And I will tell you, it still to this day helps me think about how to do things in the most efficient way. From how you set up your desk so you're not reaching too far to how many steps does it take to how do you create processes and systems? Like now we're all into automation. Automation is literally the computer version of lean.
Cool. Yeah. I know in my undergrad, my supply chain class might've been like the hardest class I had to take. That professor, she was tough. She told us, if you take one of my tests and you don't know the answer, just mark C. So this particular test, me and my friend, we studied all night. We actually studied for the week. We know it's a tough class. And we got to the test. He was looking at it. And all I know is every time I kept looking back, he was marking C. I was marking C. But surprisingly, I got out of class with a B, surprisingly. It was so tough. You had people dropping it before we even did our first test because they was like, they were just scared of her. And I was like, she also said, if you just listen to her and do what she says, you'll pass as well. So I was like, I think you just need to see it through, because I was trying to get through school. I ain't had time for all that dropping and stuff. I was like, look, I'm trying to get out of here. Y'all can stay, not me.
So HG, I think you bring up a point that people need to hear again, right? When I think about employees working for employers, knowing what success looks like and what does it take to pass? What does it take to be successful? And doing that is really important. I think a lot of leaders don't often articulate clearly what success looks like. And not enough of us go back and ask, you're giving me this task. Now, what does success look like at the other end of it? And if I get lost, where's my C button? That contracting, I think, is really important in the workspace of what does success look like when I'm done, so that I'm not chasing my tail out here.
Yeah, no, I agree. Of course, that's one of the good old questions I like to ask in an interview, is what is success like in this role? But we really do go back and ask that. Now, granted, there are roles to where you have either deliverables or things you created throughout the years, whether it be in JIRA or some type of way where you can say, I did like these 30 things. Let's look at what I did and how they add value to the company. There are other roles that either the manager is not helping you with that, or you're the employee, you don't know to ask that. You don't know how to big up yourself and all these other things. So you might have been successful or unsuccessful the whole time, and you just don't know just because you haven't asked the right question. So I'm actually glad that you brought that up.
Yeah, and I would say, don't wait to the end of the year to ask the question. So for all y'all folks who are out here in this tech space, I find two things. One is, you're either working for somebody who's very technical and like you and granularly looking at your stuff all the time, or you have something non-technical and they don't know what you do. Either way, it's important for you to check in periodically. I would say if it's 30 days out and you haven't had a conversation about what you've been putting out, you're not doing yourself a service. It's really good for your leader to see you frequently and often discussing the work, your contribution, and what opportunities, because they will then remember you and you being accountable to them. But if you don't do that and it's the end of the year and you're expecting them to know that you've been working, not in these streets. Don't do that. Don't do that at all.
So I know you talked about the path of going from doing procurement and to getting into HR. What kind of struggles did you face making that type of career pivot internally?
So the first challenge I made was that when I identified I wanted to get an HR, I actually found a project that was HR related, like it was tangential, as creating an entire training program. And I talked to the HR person I was working for at the time. I was in procurement. She's like, oh yeah, this will be great. They gave me the resources. I created an entire training system. Everyone loved it, even the VP of the organization. I think I got an award. And then I was like, okay, now how do I get into the leadership development program? I talked to the next level VP of HR, and I think she might have been a director at the time. And I said, listen, and she looked like us, right? So everybody said, oh my God, you got to talk to her. She's amazing. I'm sure she's going to help you out because that's what we do. That's not what happened. Sis looked at me and was like, okay, I don't know what you want me to do for you because you don't have a degree in HR. Okay. And I tried to talk to other HR people who were in roles, but it was competitive. It was a Fortune 50 company and they were not doing a lot of cross-functional moves in and out of a function. That's actually hard. Happened to go to a dinner with a friend of mine who was getting honored at the company level and sat next to a guy and we had a great conversation, older gentleman. And we talked for a long time. And we talked about all the stuff you shouldn't talk about at work, like politics and money and religion. We talked about all that stuff. And at the end of the day, he's, hey kid, if you ever need anything, let me know. And I said, sir, don't say that if you don't mean it. Now, mind you, I didn't know who I was talking to at the time, HD. Kids don't do this at all. I get back home. Dude was like, do you know who you're talking? I'm like, nice. He was like, that's the VP of HR. He was one of five VPs of HR for the entire company. This is a global Fortune 50 company. I was chopping it up with him like I knew him. And after trying to get into HR for the third time, had another conversation with that lady. She wasn't budging. I call this guy and say, hey, listen, I'm thinking about leaving the company because I can't get into HR. Come see me. So I went and saw him in Bethesda from Jersey. And I told him, he said, who have you been asking for help? I told him, and he said, okay, I need you to remember to not to talk to anybody about your problems who can't help you. And from there, before I got back to Jersey, I had three voicemails from other leaders in the company ready to help me get into this program. And within, I don't know, 60 days, I had my first HR job and then got into the leadership development program after I interviewed for it. So it was network, it was grace, it was God's grace, it was luck, whatever you want to call it. It was a combination of me being tenacious and not being okay with no, but also being willing to, as the children say, shoot my shot. Listen, the worst they can say is no, mm-hmm. Right?
Best they can say is yes. Funny enough, it's one of those things we always talk about. Your network, the network. And then a lot of people are like, what are y'all talking about? My network. And the fact that I haven't even read the full scope of these degrees of separation, but we literally are probably a couple of degrees separated from some very powerful people, whether it's a company or it's countrywide, statewide, you name it. But the fact that you were able to be at that event and just let people know who you are. I think that's one of the more important things. And I always say people like to work with people they like. And you prove that just because y'all were just enjoying each other's company. Mm-hmm. You didn't have to worry about having the zip-on suit of like your fake corporate voice or giving the correct corporate answers versus just talking candidly how you would talk if you were at home.
Yeah, I'm gonna say something. I do have a corporate voice, but that's like my normal voice. Right. So one of our mutual friends used to laugh at me. She's like, Nellie, you talk white. I'm like, yes, but it's going to make me money. And coming up in corporate America, what I did, that was necessary. It was necessary to code switch. It was necessary to show up in a certain way. But I will say, I didn't shrink back. Like I sat next to it. And I will tell you that day I looked horrible. Like I had this, I was like, it was like a lot of fashion faux pas in that situation. But I just showed up. And I'm going to talk to you because I can talk to the janitor or to the senator. It doesn't matter. And for me, that's really what's important is how do you share space with people and create meaningful moments? And I didn't really want anything from him. I didn't know to want anything from him, if that makes sense. Because I think people can sense when you are posturing and positioning yourself. And it wasn't that.
Yeah, for sure. We could tell when it's authentic and it was fake. And that's why I always say nothing beats in-person networking. Nothing. Like it's
agreed.
It's the best thing. Now, after you get your first HR job, how was that?
No, as a matter of fact, it got worse. So what happens that people don't tell you that, like when you get sponsorship, depending on the sponsor and depending on who you are, it can actually get worse. because from there, everyone was trying to figure out who I was and why I got this opportunity. And my first role into HR was a training and development job. And the leader at the time was a three-time degree, recent doctorate, African-American male, very smart. But your man was not feeling me because he thought that I was somebody's kid. So he thought I got the job through nepotism. So when I showed up with my box and excited about my HR job in the training center, dude was like, okay, here's your office. And was really cold for the first month. Not because he was mean per se, but because he had asked for a resource. And I'm sure he wanted a resource that was educated and degreed and experienced in the space that he was working in. Here we are, early 2000s. He's a director, again, Fortune 50 company of training and development, a systems engineer, if I'm not mistaken. Like, he had all of the things. And so here I come in, green and wet behind the ears, and he's looking at me like, who are you? And I had to prove myself to him. Like, I had to prove myself a lot. And while he gave me work, I had to make it a point to figure out what was important to him, how to show up and be of value to him, and eventually got more accountability and more opportunity. And he went from being cold the first couple of months to when I got ready to leave and move to Florida. He, myself, the admin, and one of our other colleagues, we all cried, right? Because we had become family, which was really cool.
That's good. I know it seems, you know how like it's one of those, I don't know if it's a black trope or whatever, but like sometimes the older generation, they're not as happy that sometimes the younger people didn't have to claw and struggle like them for whatever reason. Sometimes they feel like you need to go through what they did for whatever reason. And I feel like that's a little bit how they feel, just because who cares, even if you're a Nepo baby, if you know how to do the work, you know how to do the work. So I think that's the thing how I feel. Now, if you're a Nepo baby and you don't know how to do anything, then I'd be like, yeah, you got to get them out of here. But if you know how to do it, I could care less because everybody else does it. So why not you? Why not you? But I do see that sometimes.
But I will say that more often than not, in the roles that I've had, even I was on a board, I was president of an association. And those folks, those our elders, they were not kind because they were like, where did you come from? And you're too young. And I'm like, I got a whole life and family and managed budgets and everything. But they didn't care. All they knew is I was 20 years their junior and they thought I was young. And it's rough. It's rough. It's an interesting thing. I think when you find out what's important to people and offer value, then it's irrelevant. Because you could get stuck in that feeling like, you're not going to be mean to me because I'm young. If you think their madness is their thing, but I can still come and perform and put numbers and points on the board.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I'm like, I don't know. And so while we actually added, this actually gave me, I guess, a little pivot real quick. On social media the last week or so, the discourse has been around Black men and the literacy gap that they have of either higher education or not going to school. And I know also with you working in HR, you probably even seen this more oftentimes than not when it comes to having degrees or not having degrees or different things that they may struggle with. And I've actually did like my own TikTok video on it. I'm not like the TikToker, but I do chime in on some of these things sometimes. And there's a lot of different, I'd just say it's a lot of interesting commentary when it comes to this topic. I will say that. But I will ask you from your expertise, why do you think that we are not seeing a lot of Black men go? And we also, when we say higher education, we also are including trade school in this too, because a lot of people think that, oh, we can go get a trade. I was like, technically, you still got to go somewhere after high school and learn some more. So we are including this. The first thing that a lot of the guys want to say on my videos, loans or whatever, whoop-de-woo, and I'm like, there's a way to get a cheaper degree and not have a lot of student debt. So I was like, I really don't want to hear that excuse. So I wanted to see what your take might be on that.
So the first thing I want to talk about is the trade versus the degree. One, I actually think, this is my futuristic hat, I actually think we're going to see the pendulum shift away from standard 4-year degrees and over to trades. everything that's happening. I think some of the highest paid people are about to be people out here driving a forklift, a truck, or whatever. One, because there's now a demand for that work. And two, that I expect some manufacturing will come back to the States, and you're going to need welders and all these other things, right? So go get a trade. I don't want to say it's easier. It's a different kind of thinking for those who can do that. But for the degrees piece, I think here's what happens. One, I don't believe, and this might be really, I'm going to just say this out loud. The American education system was not built for us. It just wasn't. And I believe that the way that we learn, especially our brown boys, I think that there's a disservice, a gap, a lack of compassion and all of that. I feel like there's something to be done in the space of how we teach our kids. That's my perspective. Especially raising a young black boy. When he was younger, it was like, oh, he's so cute. Now that he's older, he's bigger. There's a tone and tenor and a lot of microaggressions that shift in the conversation around how he behaves. And I believe that the support system around black men, and I will also say men in general, because the Wall Street Journal was either Journal or New York Times. Somebody had an article about how more women are getting degrees and less men, right? And there are more women marrying now what they're calling marrying down, so that women will marry men who have less education than them, but white man won't do the same, or even black man won't do the same. So there's this interesting gap. I believe that a lot of us don't know how to utilize and leverage the systems to get the kinds of things that we want. I'd also argue that are we taught to want the right thing, right? We are taught to grow up, get good grades, and get a good job. Grow up, get good grades, and get a good job to make money. But we're not taught to figure out what's your purpose? What do you do? How can you make money? And I think that's why you see a lot of us who've been in this corporate space say, okay, we got to the echelon. We made it to the mountaintop and there's nothing here. So what do we do instead of this? What do we do that's going to really fulfill our soul, fill our cups, make us not just happy, but beyond and in purpose? And so I think for me, part of the systematic issues is not only around the education system and the lack of support and the lack of differentiated education. I think there's also just we needing to understand how to navigate these systems more effectively because they weren't built for us. I don't know if that's a controversial perspective, but it's mine. No.
As you didn't say what a lot of us have said, the foundation starts at the home. If we break down, if we specifically talk about our community, a lot of these boys don't have fathers. A lot of them don't see white collar men on a day-to-day basis, but who they do see are your athletes, your rappers, your streamers. So they see all these people. So college is not necessarily something pushed on them, or a lot of them don't believe they can. A lot of the parents, if we have homes, we know the average income in America is not high. And if I go to Bureau of Labor Statistics for African Americans, it's even lower. So you factor that into with the person probably having like maybe one or two lower paying jobs and the kids raising themselves and just getting skipped on throughout the years, not knowing how to read, not how to do all this other stuff. So to them, because I've seen when I went to graduation, I was like, why are y'all so happy somebody graduated high school? Like, to me, I was like, it's like school was never hard for me. Matter of fact, that's the reason why I got in a lot of trouble a lot of time, even from a young age. I'm finishing my work super fast. And so now I don't have anything to do. So I'm getting into trouble because I'm either talking too much, I don't have anything to do. Whereas school probably should be different for kids. I don't even think they need 8 hours at school, honestly. They probably just need 5 to 6, learn what they need to learn, let them go play. Boys should actually be playing more than the women. I don't want to make it sexist, but I think that's just how we operate. On lunch shift, the boys are taking their clothes off and they're going in the gym to play basketball. That's what they're doing. The girls are around their friends, they're eating their food, and they're talking or whatever. They're not acting the same way the guys do. It's like you can already tell right there that our minds focus more so on this physical thing more, or just having too much energy Yeah. Just have too much energy and not want to sit down all day, and them continually to make you sit down all day is, I know this stuff, or why do I have to sit down this whole time? And it honestly feels like school, it really does just try to prepare you to go work for somebody. In a sense, okay, when you get a job, you're going to be sitting down 8 hours a day, so you got to know how to do this for 8 hours for however many years we're in school, and then you're going to do that for 40, 50 years. And that's what it feels like when you take a step back.
There's a school of thought about the fact that the Rockefellers and others created these systems to create compliance, to create a controllable workforce. Go do your research. I think that's there's something to be said for that. And that's really what I was leaning into around. I know my kid, neurodiverse or not, I know that if he does not in some way burn off energy, he can't hear you. And for me, and maybe it's not just for Black kids, but I know my Black kid has a hard time with just sitting down. And so how do we teach people, how do we teach our kids in the way that they can learn? The systems that we currently have are not the most effective for that. And there's not a lot of wiggle room based on the way that they're created. I want to go back to the whole family situation. So I am blessed in a couple of different ways. I had a two-parent household, right? I am a part of a two-parent household. And we read to our kids every night. My son's like, I don't want it. My daughter's like, please read to me. And it's an interesting dynamic. I believe the foundation is important. There's no part of me, but I also understand that's not possible for everybody. I understand that for the single mom who has to work to keep food on the table, that's not. And she trusts the system that she's putting her child in to help with that. I will also say that we're not doing ourselves a service by not letting our kids understand the world that they're in, to help them understand, like to help them see past the year in front of them, to say, listen, your end goal in this life is this. Like, you need to think about the entire arc of your life, not just this high school or college mm-hmm. or what have you. How do you be intentional in planning the entire life?
Yeah, no, I agree. And once we get off the topic, this is the last thing I'll answer that and we'll move on. But now couple that with, I want to say, most Americans read on about fourth grade level, just in general. So when you think about you getting mad at that person that's doing customer service or whatever on the phone, once you realize what the problem is, you really can stop being mad. Like, you know what? It's not me. It's them. That's literally like a lot of times when you find out that, or I brought up in my video how, hey, a lot of these kids are pretty much don't know how to do anything. They get frustrated. They don't know how to communicate. The first thing they want to do is fight. That's what they understand. That's why you will always see that a lot of times in inner city schools. They want to fight because, hey, I'm not going to get my point across and you're making me mad. Or a lot of times you would see if another kid showed more ability or more intelligence, at least in kind of like just book sense or just understanding things better, it would make the other people feel small and they would get mad. That's how kids would start getting bullied or stuff, just because of, they don't know how to say, hey, how do you know all this stuff? How can I, like, that to them is, oh, you're trying to make a fool of me or this or that, or verbally abuse me, which some kids do need it because they are actually trying to make a fool of people, knowing that, hey, they're not your intellectual
equal. Yeah.
Equals a better word.
So here's, I'll say this. I have been an advocate, and I hope sometime in this life I'll be able to see it. I believe that every kid should start learning both communication and conflict resolution at like pre-K. It should be a curriculum all the way up until postdoc, because you will always have conflict in life. You will always communicate with someone in life. And so wouldn't we do ourselves a service, especially in fields like tech, where everybody excuses the fact that the software programmer or the code, they can't, oh, don't worry about him. He's just a little rough around. No, you need to learn how to talk to people. You need to learn how to express your idea in a way that people can hear you, because that's what makes you effective, especially in this knowledge workspace. It makes no sense to me where we teach all this randomness and half of it you will never use in life. Teach people how to communicate, and not just convey information, but teach people how to listen. Teach people how to respectfully disagree. I don't understand it. It's a chief frustration.
No, I agree. All right. Now back to the regular schedule program.
Tangents.
But no, I think it was just an unnecessary conversation because everybody's giving their opinion. You got people in higher ed, and we interact with a lot of these people in the workforce, or I do consultations with some of these people where I'm like, okay, I'm getting a feed for where I think you are and what you may struggle with or what level I think you may be on and what you need to do for you even want to get services from me. No, I definitely feel you. So after you leave the first company where you did your HR stint, you said you moved to Florida?
So I was with that company for 12 years and we did two moves. I was in Orlando for a couple of years and then was in Maryland for about 8 before I left and went to Amtrak. I worked for them for 2 years.
Okay. So you must have got like a promotion or something. That's why like you left the people for their first role.
So when I first left the defense contractor, I left because 12 years in, I had gotten multiple different promotions, multiple different jobs, and really enjoyed the work. I was a manager, had a team underneath of me. Organization started to shift. My guardian angel retired and a couple other people that I had been in my network that were advocates of me left. And a new guard was coming in and I had to decide whether or not I was going to align with the new situation or if I needed to go somewhere else. And having done the HR business partner thing, so the business partners typically do help with the talent acquisition, help the managers determine their roles, help the managers manage the people, all that stuff. I didn't like that stuff. I had done it for a while. And I'm like, listen, I want to go into organizational development. I just got my degree at George Washington. And I'm like, I want to roll an OD. We've been doing this for years. And they're like, yeah, we don't have any more OD jobs. And I'm like, but you say I'm a high potential and you guys value me. Yeah, but we don't have any of those jobs. So you can either go move here to, it was like Denver or somewhere crazy. Or I was like, yeah, I don't want to do that. And my dad had died 2 years before. And I was like, I've done enough, you know, working in that company. I was 70 hour work weeks. We were just doing all of the things. So I left. And as soon as I left, I got called by a headhunter to come work for Amtrak and do OD under them. And that was a lot of fun. We stood up their performance management program, their succession planning programs. We did competency modeling, level 9 across the entire system, which was really awesome. Did that for a year. And then I got tapped on the shoulder to be a business partner because the C-suite of folks that I was supporting in the OD stuff liked the work that we did. So they're like, we want Natalie to be our business partner. Did that and ended up getting married, having our first kid, and ended up reporting to somebody that I didn't necessarily have the best experience with. And it made sense for us to leave. So left there and came down here to the Charlotte area and started working for the forestry company and was the OD leader for all of the US.
Nice, nice. Now, funny enough, I'm like, we've been in this whole episode so far, and I haven't asked you like one of the key questions is, what is human resources in your own words?
Human resources is the function that helps with all of the people stuff from hiring to exit. We do everything from designing the system to enter the person into the workforce. In many cases, the employer brand also sits with HR. Then to developing them, helping design the role to make sure they're getting the most out of it. Talent development is the space that I love where it's like, who goes what and what do they do and how do we get them more experience to be ready for the next job? We do leadership development and coaching. So we're helping the leaders coach them to better places so they can be better for the employees. And then a compensation is also a part of it. Benefits is also a part of it. But then the exit.
Nice. And then the next question is, you said this OD word a lot.
Organizational development.
I'm calling it back for the audience. So when do companies typically seek to get that? Like when do you, in your experience, have seen that happen?
So one of my first major things was designing a performance management program for an entire workforce. So it's, what's the system, the HRIS system, the HR information system? What's the system that we're going to use? What hopefully do we value as an, what'd you say?
I said, hopefully it's not work.
Oh, no work day. And what, and how do we design it in a way that it reflects our values as an organization? And what's the cadence? What's the rhythm? What's the communications? It's the entire system. and designing that for the organization. And so we look at things like that. We look at things like, all right, we have a group of mid-level managers who are high potential. We want to develop them from here to there. And so we look at the system around that. Who's going to mentor? What are we mentoring? What are we coaching? How do we assess them? And how do we build a program to ensure that we're getting something out of the accelerated investment we're making in them? It's also, we're doing an entire organizational redesign. We need to restructure. Okay, Natalie, come in and help us think about how we set up the people to meet the business objectives. So it's really the people architecture of the organization.
Perfect, perfect. Now, so you were at Amtrak for 2 years, and how was that just being in that industry? That would be transportation? Mm-hmm. Like, how was that? Because I know, like, I've been in finance the last, 4 years now? And so it's different from previously working more so in security center organizations. So I guess what's the biggest difference between defense contractor, technically like GovTech, to...
It was fun. I loved Amtrak because I came in at a time where, so they give you a badge, and I didn't know that the railroad itself was like a fraternity. So it doesn't matter if it's passenger, and Amtrak is like the only national passenger railroad, right? But then you've got the city ones, you've got commuter rails, like the railroad itself is a family, fraternity, what have you. And so we could get on, I could go on, people would see my badge on like a MARC train in DC, conductor pay with, there was just an awareness of people. Like, we got the nod, like the railroad just have their own little, and it was fun. Like, we could go anywhere and be like, okay, get on my badge. And they would let us on the train, just let you on the train. And the people in the railroad who really do like railroading, they're just really just salt of the earth people. They're so down to earth. They're good at their craft, which is almost like a dying craft because there's not a whole lot of people. So I'm like, let me go work on a railroad. I enjoyed it a lot. It's got its own type of nonsense with it. Huge labor relations. So a lot of unionized stuff going on in the organization. It's a quasi-government system. So the finances were also very interesting. But the culture itself was, for me, a lot of fun. It was very, and a lot of history with the railroad as well.
Some other questions here before we talk more about Natalie Parker Enterprises. I think one thing is, okay, so let's say somebody is watching this right now, and maybe they're thinking of pivot into human resources. Based on your 20-year, or it might be even more experience, but based on your experience, what can you see, I guess, like salary-wise, what you typically see from like an entry-level person all the way up to whatever that you did in HR for us? What does that look like for if someone could probably over a career they could possibly make in HR?
Oh, my. So I'd say entry-level with some level of experience starting somewhere between 50 and 60. And it just depends on the function. Right. And I say function, I think compensation is different than talent acquisition, is different than benefits, which is different than HR information systems, which is different than business partnering. Right. But at a VP level, senior VP level, you could easily clear 200 to 300 in base, not considering bonus. So it's a nice, and it depends on the size of the organization, but it's a nice cross section. You can make good money in HR, especially if you're good at it.
So when you say entry level with some experience, how does a person get HR experience?
So a lot of the schools now easily have internships or what have you, where you can get some level of experience. I think because HR is a people-based function, you could do a lot and be considered HR experience, from designing and developing training to resource management. So if you have to manage resources and people and do what we consider workforce strategy, which is basically how many people do we need? Where are they coming from? What's the skill set and where do we need to deploy them to? You could easily show some kind of experience, at least tangential experience, that would qualify you at least for a conversation.
Okay, cool. Scenario. Person A has a issue with person B at the company, but person B is probably seen to be a little bit more valuable than person A. What should they do from an HR perspective about either reporting this or going about this situation?
What should person A do?
Person A is the person that has the issue with person B, but person A knows it's going to be one of those their word versus mine type of stuff.
Oh, yeah. Oof. Give me like a scenario. Give me like a, is it a cheating? Is it stealing? Is it misappropriating work?
Let's just say they're having issues with a tough manager, or the manager is always taking credit for their work.
Oh.
It's other little stuff that people tend to go through sometimes at the workplace. Microaggressions, getting treated differently from other employees, those type of things.
The thing that we say on the podcast all the time, I said I was going to make a t-shirt, document everything. I mean, everything. And the engagements, the interaction, the time, the place, who was there. Because much of what's hard to do, especially from an HR perspective, when someone is brought to us with like they're having a problem, we're going to first try to get you to reconcile it yourself or try to be a mediator. But if it's something like ethical or illegal or moral, what have you, we need evidence. And more often than not, people will come with just generalizations and not evidence. And we can't do anything with that. And the minute you raise that flag, you got to be ready for whatever consternation comes with the fact that you raised that flag. So if you don't have your receipts in hand, it's not a lot we're going to be able to do it for you. And I tell people all the time, unless you have this very niche skill set, more often than not, the company's not going to give you the tiebreaker. They're going to give it to the manager. So you have to be very aware of what's your intention. What do you want to get out of it? If you want the person to behave differently, is there a way for you to confront them in a way that's disarming, but still gets your point across? For example, if a manager comes and gives you some kind of microaggression, oh, I can't believe you're eating that today, or some version of that, right? Or, oh, I can't believe you decided to give me this report 3 days late, or some version of that. Like they give you some kind of what we call sass, right? Ask very bluntly, it sounds like you're displeased. Can I help you with something? Learn how to ask the direct question in a passive way that puts the person at attention to let them know that you see what they're doing. Right? Another way to consider what you need to do yourself is figure out what your end game is. Do you want to repair the relationship? Do you even want to have a relationship with the person? Is it irreconcilable? Are you ready to just burn the bridge? Because I'm not against burning some bridges. I don't burn them all, but I'm okay with burning a few. I think it's important for you to understand like the long game of your career. What's the thing you want out of this situation, and how is that going to play into the end goal of making your next promotion or getting the next thing? Because if the person is well liked and well loved or whatever, you're going to have a hard time getting people in your corner, even if they know they're wrong. Because more often than not, the conversation is going to be around, you should really do this. People are usually going to point you back to yourself. So if you can manage it yourself without taking on any undue stress or trauma or what have you, I would say try to do that. I'd also figure out if you know somebody that's neutral to the both of you that can speak to the person and give them some perspective. That's always a good, I like triangulation when I don't have the capital to talk to the person. Do you know somebody who could talk to them, not on your behalf, because you don't want to seem weak, but could you get someone to like ask questions like, hey, I think Natalie's great. How's she going with you? Like, how do you get somebody to advocate on your behalf? And the third thing is, if you're really trying to pull the ripcord on an investigation or an inquiry, have all of your documentation in a row. And the documentation doesn't need to have a lot of energy in terms of your perspective. It needs to have the facts. On this day, he said that. On this day, she said that. On this day, he did this. And here were the people in the room that saw it. Get enough of that and then share it. And keep whatever emails that also support it.
Okay. Now, here's a fun one. What are some perks that people don't typically negotiate in their offer letter or their compensation package? Or maybe I should reframe and say, what's the most interesting thing you've seen someone negotiate for in coming into a company or something?
I've seen a swap when a company couldn't make them, like the company couldn't meet the financial demands. They asked for more vacation. For some of companies that are more structured, they tend not to make those concessions, but you know, like, okay, you can't give me this, we'll give you, you know, an extra week. I've seen at the executive level some really interesting things, like, you know, usage of vehicles and things like that, which was pretty dope. Also, if the company has some kind of long-term incentive plan or what have you, negotiating into that as well. So giving me a piece of stocks, and again, you can't give me what I want. Give me this instead.
Yeah. Have you ever seen some of those companies? I guess it would depend though. Some of these companies, they own communities and apartments and stuff like that. Like, hey, I know y'all own one of the apartments right there. You know what I'm saying? Go ahead and give me a penthouse suite.
I have not worked for anybody that posh that I know of. I've done temporary housing and corporate housing. A lot of assignments. Yeah. I've been able to either negotiate into a corporate housing for an extended period of time or seen that happen for sure.
How does that work? Is it just I was explaining that they have not a subdivision, but they have like maybe a couple of houses or where people stay at while they're transitioning to either be full-time the company or something like that?
So in the cases that I've personally had, it's, we're going to move you here. So we are going to help you find the realtor of choice or whatever, or they know where there's a lot of places that come fully furnished because of executive lifestyle. And they will pack your whole house up, put it on the ship, put it on the back of a truck, and put it in storage. And you go live in this other house until you're ready to find and help you buy your house. So in one instance, no, actually multiple instances I've had where it's okay, I'm moving here. You're also going to help me find my house. So you're going to pay for the realtor. You're going to also help offset these fees. You're going to help me get this loan. It's when companies have those resources, look into them for sure.
Yeah. I show them like, you know what? I'll just stay in the corporate housing. Executives don't stay at companies long anyway.
Listen, for sure. I'm interested, HD, like what are some of the work challenges your audience is having? Like, what are you hearing? What are you seeing on your side?
A lot of them are. So I think I would say one of the biggest ones is from just having consults with people is a lot of them are not. They don't have brag sheets.
Can I tell my story?
Yeah, go ahead.
So my first performance review with my first company, I had been there a year. No, it might've been my second performance review. I'd been there a year, 2 years now, and I had done all this stuff. So I told you I got green belt and black belt certified within the same year, which is unheard of. I had ran all these projects. I went to various locations to implement systems. Like, so we had a new procurement system and I went and trained the people on how to use the system. I did all stuff that beyond my normal day-to-day job. And I went to go get assessed for my performance review. And they were about to give it to me on Good Friday. I remember this. They were going to give it to me on Good Friday and I was out. We were at church somewhere, right? So my manager never met with me. I came back on Monday. They closed it before I could even see it or sign it. And they signed it electronically on my behalf, which I thought was really shady. So I opened it up and it said meet expectation. And I went off. I went all the way off. And I was hot. I was so hot. And I talked to one of my I only talked to one of my colleagues. So this is something I'll tell you guys, like on the side. If you get upset at work, don't talk to 75 people. Don't talk to 75 people. Don't waste your time. Write down what your challenges are. Talk to one person that you trust to give you good counsel. But don't waste your time talking to 75 people. Don't everybody need to know your business. Went to this one person. She's like, look, go take all of the stuff because I know you've done this. She's like, take this and this and bring it together in a folder and take it to your leader and ask her, can you explain this to me? And that's what I did. I took a binder and I still have this binder to this day. It's this thick and it had all of the personally made training modules that I made for and delivered to 100 people in a system of procurement. I had all of the projects that I made and how much money I saved the company as a junior professional. And I said, so can you tell me how this meets performance? Were you really expecting me to do all this stuff as a junior person? Oh, Natalie, you're great. And we think so highly of you. But that's not what this says. It says, I just got to see, right? Like, I need you to understand. Help me understand. And I ended up having to appeal the rating. And after they reviewed it and investigated, I got my rating changed. Now, granted, there was no love lost between me and my leader at that point, because I didn't trust her and she was mad at me for going over her head and it brought attention to her. But what you're not going to do is play with my money. Because more often than not, your performance rating is a direct correlation to how much money you get in the compensation package. So don't let people do that to you. If you don't have a running tab of what you've done, you are doing yourself a disservice. And here's why, HD, because companies are now bragging that they're about to get rid of all of the middle management. So if you're going to make organizations flatter, that means the span of control, the number of people a manager has to have, top end is 12. Like a person can manage 12 people, especially if they're all doing the same thing. But if you're in tech, more often than not, your manager probably doesn't do what you do. So not only are they not going to know how to do what you do, but they're not going to know what you do unless you tell them. So you have to keep a running tab because these people will not know what you're doing. And they will only come to you when something's wrong. So it's important that you not only keep a running tab, but what I personally recommend, and I've done this for the last 15 years of my career, I would send a weekly update of here's what happened this week. Here's what I did this week. Here are the outcomes. Because you're going to know. I'm going to be my own billboard for my success. Because if you have to be the advocate in the room when it comes to performance management, for me, I'm going to make sure my words are in your mouth.
No, I agree. And I think that reminds me, I believe we also talked about how while companies never want to give you exceeding expectations, when they know you exceeded expectations to get that raise or that promotion. I think we talked about that.
So, yeah. So here's what happens. A lot of companies is that there is a configured curve. Like they use the Pareto chart of distribution. It goes like this, right? In the long tail and 10% on the bottom, 10% at the top, and everybody's mushed in the middle. And the intention behind this is twofold. One is to make sure that the company can afford whatever merit-based compensation there is. That's usually the first intention. The second intention is usually also to try to mitigate leaders being lazy and not giving the feedback of Bob didn't do that great. So they try to really create an exclusiveness around high performance, which is a bit bipolar because most companies talk about being high performing. And then, so there's this reserved idea that everybody can't be high performing. And so there's a bit of craziness in the design of most performance management systems that don't help the concept of both community, everyone helping each other out, what have you, because it's every man for himself. It's actually quite cannibalistic in my perspective.
Yeah, that reminds me of like over the last couple of years when it's come to certain tech companies, they've said, oh, we're laying off the employees that weren't doing well. But then you found out, hey, they were sabotaging the people's reviews or what they were doing with this whole return to office stuff was they knew a lot of these people were nowhere near the building that they would have to come work into and saying, hey, you got to come in or else. So they was forcibly just letting employees force their way out, whether either firing them or possibly giving them a little severance, depending on the company, if they actually want to be decent. And so we saw a mix of those things in those corporate games that people didn't realize. Yeah, it's a war zone out here. You got to know how to navigate, unfortunately.
It's the truth. Like, honestly, we should write the book on the games corporates plays because there's a ton of them. And it's unfortunate. I think the return to work thing is very complex. These folks out here paying these rents for these places that are empty. You'd be mad if you were paying rent on a building and it was empty too. And I think it's also important to recognize that I think we're going to see surgence of elitism when it comes to this. So the lower level employees will be less prone or able to work from home and everybody knows, as you get higher, you get more flexibility. That's always been the case, but I think you're going to see more of that. I'd also say that when it comes to this idea of the lower 10%, I think you have to be realistic about your contribution and what you're doing, and knowing that you don't see what everybody else says, but you owe it to yourself to make sure you understand what your manager wants and make them accountable to you to tell them when you're not doing that. You should not be surprised by any of the conversations. If you are, you're partly to blame.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I will also say, I think a lot, some people should just be in office because like they're just starting off because they don't know much, and I think it's going to benefit them to be in office some. Then the other people is sometimes companies want them to come in office 4 or 5 days a week, but yet everything else around your employees has increased from rent, food, gas, whatever, yet their salary didn't. And so now you want them to come in, but here's my incentive. They probably say your job is like, I saved a lot of money and I have to come into you guys with this gas and all this other stuff being flexible. Meanwhile, a lot of times they'll have you come into office to virtually call your teammates that do not work in the same place as you. And your mind is, you can't make this up. Like, this don't make sense to me at all. I could have did this at home because these people that I work with are not even here. It'd be different if they were here, but they're not. What is my purpose?
I've lived this life two different ways. The first time was living in Gaithersburg, Maryland, and commuting all the way to Alexandria, Virginia. It might be 25 miles tops. I think it may have been 20. But in DC traffic in 2010-15 perspective, that was easily an hour and a half one way, door to door. One way, just one way, an hour and a half. Let it be a really bad storm or really bad rain, and it's a 3-hour commute one way. And at the time, there wasn't a lot of work from home. It was like you slip out and you go home and you finish your work and nobody knows where you are. But most of the time, they were expecting me to be in that office by myself because everybody else was on a customer contract. Hated it. I remember one specific time coming down 270. Shout out to anybody who's on 270, right? It was a tanker, an oil tanker, came off the overpass onto the highway. I was stuck on the highway for 3 hours. 3 hours. I think I got to work at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Snowmageddon, whenever that was, 2010, 2012. I'm 10 miles from home, 7 miles from home. Bethesda to Gaithersburg is not that far. It took me 4 hours to get home in that snow. Like, we're not doing ourselves favors. During COVID, living here in Charlotte suburbs, they are like, oh, I worked for home for years in this company. Years I worked for home. And COVID, oh, we're shifting your job and we want you to move to Tennessee. Why? Because that mill needs you. It's in the middle of a pandemic. I just had my daughter like a year before, maybe two. I'm not moving in the middle of a pandemic. I'm not. And my husband just became pastor. So we decided that I would commute. I'd leave on Monday, drive 6 hours to Tennessee to go sit in an office by myself in the middle of a pandemic because we weren't allowed to be around each other. It's bananas. We do this to people. And I think for all conversations around the psychological contract that employees have with work, companies are consistently dismantling that. If you don't know what the psychological contract is, it's your ability to appreciate the norms that you have. Like, we've built this norm and this is what I've come to expect. Your company, you work, you get a paycheck. That's a part of the psychological contract. And as you have all these norms, they become a part of what you expect. What I think is really most egregious is not that the expectation changes, that they change abruptly with no concept or concern for the fact that it's going to make an issue for you, right? It's going to be inconvenient. There's no conversation. It's just, this is what we decided. So you got to figure out what you're going to do. It's crappy.
Very crappy. And speaking of, since we talk about all the games, since the pandemic, we've seen a rise in overemployment. Now, a couple of weeks ago, me and the panel reacted to a man that was working. I forgot how many jobs. I probably had 6 or 7 jobs. And he was quietly going to make $800K that year, being overemployed doing QA testing. And he had pretty much was hiring like other people to work for him and different things. And he was getting around it, but I really would say that's on those companies on how he was able to do that. Cause you shouldn't be able to use some of the tools he was using just from a security standpoint. However, I get why companies are against it, but then again, I don't. Because they do mergers and acquisitions and they go out and buy companies and then they're able to increase their revenue. But your employee who is maybe struggling at this time or wants to go pay debt off or, you know, wants to go get a house, you get mad at them if they have another role. Now, mind you, in this instance that we're talking about, nothing has changed the quality of their work. Their work is all good. And they picked up something else. If possibly they find out about it, then it's an issue. But I don't feel like it should be an issue if nothing is wrong with the work they're doing and if they're also not working with a direct competitor. I feel like they should be able to do what they're doing unless the company wants to pay them the other side that they're paying them. Just tack that on to what they get and then they could probably quit.
So I said this often that I believe that most American companies are like bad boyfriends. What do I mean by that? One, I don't want you seeing nobody else, girl. You mine, right? Like it's very possessive. And then when the company doesn't get when you don't get what you want out of the company and you leave, the company's mad. Don't ever come back then. It's just this very toxic situation of employment. And what makes that crazy, Henri, is that here's the deal. 50% of Americans have a side hustle. 50%. Now, from time to time, I do audits of policies and things. And I've seen clients have policies where they're like, if you work for anybody else, you have to let us know and we have to approve it. Why? That's none of your business. What I do in other hours is none of your business. And it's that concept of possession, right? I think it's sick, right? But at the same time, when you're paid 40 hours a week or whatever you're paid, especially on the salary side, they want to get to you when they want to get to you. So they feel like we've bought your time and we should have unfettered access to the time that we've paid you for. So the conflict is around this idea of your hours. Why can't you be theirs too? It's a very interesting thing. That said, if you can do that, as long as it's not illegal, immoral, unethical, knock yourself out. Just know you can't do that for long. It's not sustainable. But I do think companies have this very interesting possessive nature around the workforce until they want to fire you or term you.
Yeah, for sure. I always tell people, because I have clients, they're trying to immediately go to that. I'm like, I need you to get good at one thing first. And then you can try that, but stop trying to jump on with people who've possibly been in the game 5, 6, 7, 10 years doing. They've pretty much got their schedule set. Their meetings are set. They got it made. You don't have that luxury yet. Like, just be content. And I know the question you asked, what am I saying for my audience and my listeners? I think another thing that they struggle with is packaging. And what I mean by packaging is bad resume. Either a bad LinkedIn or none existed LinkedIn. The resume and LinkedIn's do not highlight the skill sets that would be advantageous for a company hiring them. And so they apply to all these jobs and no one says anything back to them. And I was like, this is why. And I don't care how many times I said, you said, whoever says it, these resumes are bad. And most of them aren't bad in the sense, like, I've seen some bad ones, like, I know you didn't pay anybody for that. Versus some of them are just bad because you don't, like, it's either reading as if you put your day-to-day on there or you got all these technical skills, but I don't see how they're utilized inside the bullets. So that's when I'm like, okay, we see this stuff up here, but we're not seeing how you use this stuff. So you have to make it make sense for, in this situation, the recruiter who's got 7 seconds to look at your resume. So if they don't see that in the 7 seconds, you getting the auto-rejection thing. So that's what I've been seeing for most people, because literally – I can count on the top of the hands where we redid the resume. I've audited the LinkedIn and we changed different things, made it match up and added the stuff that they're looking for and what recruiters are looking for. And they're like, yeah, hey, I just got an email today for such and such role. I said, I know you did, because now you're searchable. They can find you. If you don't have your skills out there, they can't look for what's not there.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. One of the reasons I don't like recruiting is the whole resume rigmarole. Like that is, ugh. If you guys can't see me, I cross my eyes. So here's what I think is the important thing that you said is customizing the resume for the circumstance, right? So making sure that you are answering the test when it comes to what they're looking for. The other thing that I think is important and is this differentiator is not the laundry list of things you did in a day, but what did you do and what outcome did it impact in the business? If you cannot, like every day, whether it be you're working or in your like you always need to know what contribution did I make and how can I articulate that very quickly? Because that's what we're looking for. We're looking for, do you know how to do the technical thing? But also, do you know what the work you do contributes to and how? And for a lot of folks, they don't know because they just are doing the job. So I would say, yeah, it's really about, and now with the flood of unemployed folks, that's going to, it's going to get worse. So you've got to get more in tuned, more intentional than what has been acceptable in the past, for sure.
For whatever reason, people get jobs and just stop interviewing. And for the life of me, I get it. You might like your company, but you need to interview every, whether you do every couple of months or you want to interview like a couple of times every year just to not get stale and to figure out, make sure like your skills are still marketable. What I've seen a lot of times with some people in more of the government spaces is they work on some things that in the private sector, they're not touching some of the same things that we're touching. So therefore, if they were to go try to be in the market, they may find themselves at a disadvantage because of that versus, hey, if you just keep on trying to interview, you figure out, oh, okay, but it's still okay. How can I go learn these or figure out we got some resources, how I can learn this stuff? So that's what's happening. So I should throw that in there too. Bad interviewing skills, bad soft skills, lack of confidence that they don't know how to utilize when they're in an interview. Because if you want to hire somebody, especially if you got a role where you got to either interact with a lot of upper level or executives or a client facing role, you would want to have a person that seems to know what they're talking about. Even if they're bluffing, they need to seem like they're confident in what they're saying. And a lot of people struggle with that just because of not enough time in the lab, not enough interviews of just going through and getting their confidence up as well.
So I see this a lot in the tech space is because of the kind of work that we do is it's very focused. It's very intentional. You got to be deep, right? I think that if I could tell your audience anything is learn how to talk, learn how to tell your story briefly, concisely, practice talking to yourself, your cat, your dog, your plants, right? I used to tell people all the time, you have about 7 major experiences on your resume that you can talk to for any question. So the real deal is finding out how to tell that story to meet the question. But you got to pick out the stories for us. And if you're able to do that, I also find that folks who are sometimes in the tech space, they're low energy, right? Because when it comes to people, like a lot of folks are very introverted. So talking to people and being on, they don't have the button. Get yourself an on button where you can turn on and have vocal inflection and energy. Yep. And because if you bore somebody in an interview, your energy is very contagious, and that the likelihood of you being either called back or interviewed again is slim. You have to learn how to create a personality or persona for yourself that will get you another conversation.
Yep. And another way to overcome a lot of those nerves is preparation. So really good notes in that intake screening call and ask some tough questions. That way you can have stuff to prepare for. A lot of times you may not know everything they may ask you, but maybe you prepared something that's just what the manager or hiring manager is looking for, and you possibly have a better shot if you don't know everything they're going to ask you. But how did you come up with this? They told me this, and so I worked on this at work before, and I did this, and this is the outcome that we got from that, and that's how you start bigging up yourself because you're like, okay, you know what we're looking for.
Yeah, I like that. I'd also say that, I want to add to that, that understanding that they are just as much blessed to have the conversation with you as you are to have it with them. Don't show up begging bread. Don't show up looking like Oliver Twist, like, please, sir, can I have some more? No, no, that like you being there, they're equally blessed. Hey, listen, I'm excited. I want to hear more about what you guys do. I've read this. I know this. I'm listening. I've got questions, but I also want you to know that I also belong in this space.
Yeah.
Not hubris, not ego, but just confidence in what you have done and what you know, with an understanding that you're also willing to learn.
Yeah. And also be willing to stand on what you know your value is. That's a big one. I had a screening because I briefly checked my tab and I got an update from a role I was talking to somebody about. And I really went too thrilled when I signed a convo because I don't like when you give this range and I say, okay, I would like to get XYZ. Oh, we really want to stay at somewhere that's under that. And I'm like, that doesn't make sense to me. Like, you want a person, you want me to go from being remote to coming in and to possibly take, possibly not in the lateral move to come in every day? No. I was like, so sometimes I'll say, okay, I'm already this, but I will still go through, because sometimes if you perform good enough, you could probably work some stuff out. But a lot of times they're like, nah, we want to stay cheap. But I was like, that's on you, especially if you're looking in a certain area where you know like the resources are plentiful. You're trying to get a person when they get there, man, I'm doing too much work. That's what it was. When they said exactly what they want the person to do, I said, oh no, you want 2 or 3 job functions and you're not trying to pay at the top of the thing. I've been in the game too long for you to play me. Go find somebody else.
I think that's really important. So any good recruiter will tell you, like, behind the scenes, a lot of managers don't know what they're looking for when they create the requisition. They just don't. So if you see a bunch of stuff that's thrown into the JD, the job description, ask a lot of questions, because what you don't want to do is get set up. What do I mean by that? It's a simple example. It's a non-technical example, but it's this. We saw a guy in our neighborhood get his front yard redone with like pretty flowers, and it was great. So we hire him and he does great work with that. But then my husband was like, yo, but can you do our grass? And dude was like, yeah, I could do your grass. He could not do grass. He tore up our front lawn. And I told my husband, I said, this is hiring 101. Don't hire people for a job that they're not qualified for. Like, he took on the job because we asked him to, but he wasn't really good at that. Like, it was tangential, but it wasn't germane to the function of what he does. Great horticulturalist, great flowers. The front looks great, but the grass is trash. A lot of times managers will draft a job description or a rec for a unicorn. And what they really can afford is a pony, right? So they're looking for you to have stardust and sprinkles and all this stuff. But not only can they only afford the pony, but they can probably only manage a puppy.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. I've seen that too many times. Or you'll see a role you interview for a screen with look well, but then you didn't get selected. But you see it constantly open over the months. And it comes back and you talk to the recruiters like, yeah, they're still trying to just find this magical person. And the recruiter even knows they're not going to find this person. And that's the thing that you'll see is like, some of the stuff that you want this job to do, it's not even this job's function. That's a separate department. Another role technically does that. What are y'all thinking? And you can always just tell like that. You probably don't know how to work like that anyway. So yeah, you probably will learn some, but it just doesn't make sense of how y'all are missing this or missing out on good talent, because their talent is smart enough to know, okay, hey, this is not in the job description. I technically can learn this, but I know how to do exactly what this is. All the other stuff is not important right now. I don't know why you're asking me this. So those are other things too you run into in some of these interviews. You ask me stuff that's not relevant to what I do on a day-to-day. Why?
Yeah.
Ask me about stuff I would actually encounter, not this Googleable stuff I can go throw in ChatGPT. Ask me about some stuff, you know what I'm saying, that I would hear with.
I would also tell your audience, I would tell y'all, ask this question at the end of the interview, which is, at the end of the first year, what does success look like for this job? At the end of 5 years, what does success look like in this job in terms of growth? Because if they don't have a plan for you after year two, or an idea of what potential could come, or willingness to speak to it, that's a flag for me. It might not be all the way a red flag, but definitely yellow.
Yeah. I think I've said that before too. A lot of jobs is where there's no progression plan for people. Once you get in the role, you know, that's the thing that I like I said, it can work on people that's been there, but once you get cool, there's no type of thing for them to make me do X, Y, Z. I don't see a clear path for getting promoted. I know what actually getting back to being supported by your manager looks like. Okay, I'll just play the waiting game because I know what it looks like. I was at an organization where I was very much supported. The client loved me, and I kept on getting more responsibility, and it was working out. So I know exactly what that looks like, and I know what it doesn't look like. And that's answering that question about leaving and staying. When you don't know, you don't know.
Yeah, but I think what you said is interesting is that my unscientific opinion is 2 in 10 leaders know how to manage talent. 2 out of 10.
You're right.
And what I mean by that, not just managing your tasks and making sure that you're on time, but managing and helping you grow in your career, like being intentional about it. My theory around this is this. Back in the 80s, managers were managers and only had to manage, right? Like there were a few that had the working manager. To the extent that the working manager exists now is very different than it was 20, 30, 40 years ago. Most managers now have a full-time job and a staff to overview and oversee, but not like they typically either don't have the time or the talent to really think about what do I want to do for HD? What's the next thing for him? How do I make sure he's got what he needs to get to this next level? When I was leading, my thing to my team was, my entire job is to make your resume look sexy. That's my whole job. I need you to have all these experiences so that when the next opportunity comes up, whatever that is for you, you are fully ready. Many leaders are not taught. They're not taught to think that way. So I need you all to realize you're going to go in and you're going to want this person to have all this caring, feeding and mother goose you, but they're not going to do that because most of them don't know. And then, and the company is not holding them accountable to do it. They're not even asking. They're like, they say, oh, our managers. No, they really don't teach. They don't teach these folks how to do that. And most of them don't know how to do it innately. And so if you get somebody who's willing to do that for you, stick around, stay close, ride the wave. But if the person's not, don't be mad at them. Just realize that's not their skill set and find somebody else on the periphery who will help coach you through whatever's next.
Yeah, no, for sure. But no, that was just, we could even go in more in depth of just talking about those different things because those are the conversations that are typically not happening about just on your day-to-day work. With people every day say, man, how do I improve? Or that's how to advance your cybersecurity career on LinkedIn course came about because of, okay, everybody's trying to get in cyber. Now let me show you what you could do to set yourself apart and promote. And I just took things I learned at different companies from different managers that I interacted with, also some stuff that I did in myself, and I put it together in the course specifically for that reason. Because I run into a lot of people that's, whether they're in cyber, networking, IT, or any other type of job. And it's like, I said, I see the foundation here. I see the skill set here. We got a couple of tweaks to make, and then I think you'll be okay. And that's typically what we run into with people who've been in like 3-4 years with even recent clients. It's like, you got it. It's just some other stuff that you're not doing and selling yourself enough that's holding you back.
So, yeah.
But I wanted to ask about your company a little bit more about, just talk about the things that you specialize in and what you do. I'm going to ask for the audience. Are you looking for interns? You hiring?
Not yet. So our focus, we've got a good set of clients right now. And in the summer, our goal is to expand to get some more coaches. So we're seeing a big need for coaching in the organization, mainly because the leaders that the people report to don't do it. So always interested in meeting new people who are into executive and leadership coaching. But our next big thing is really growing the platform of the podcast. So we're really excited about some of the things that are happening. We're working on some ebooks and books and resources to help people navigate the bad leader situation.
Okay. Let's actually talk about the podcast a little bit more. Let's shine some light on it.
Yes. So I've had some really bad leaders. And for those of you who are like, oh, no, she's sunshine and rainbows. No, I had a leader tell me when my dad was really sick, my mom called me like first thing in the morning, like, your dad's sick. I can't get him up. I was in DC at the time or Maryland at the time, and they were living in Jersey. 3-hour drive. So I get off the phone. I wait for my manager to come in the office. We had a meeting. I get ready to tell her like, hey, listen, I know we haven't talked in weeks, but I've done all the work that I could without you. Here's what I've got. I got to leave because my dad's sick. And she looked at, and my dad was stage 4 prostate cancer, no joke. And she looked at me and said, yeah, I'm sorry your dad is sick, Natalie, but who's going to do your work? I also had a leader tell me after a stellar performance year that in order to make it in the organization, I needed to shrink myself. I had a leader tell me after a stellar performance year, because I was getting more visibility, that I was getting too big for my britches. Like I've had some of the most obscene, insane situations. So that really birthed this idea of how do we help people with the inevitability that your leader is probably going to suck. And I mean, suck the life out of you, suck the energy, suck the creativity out of you. How do you prevent the impact of that, or at least mitigate it? And what can I bring to bear in terms of my own experiences and my network's experiences to help you realize that one, you're not alone. And two, it's inevitable in terms of the statistics. And three, you don't have to be a victim from it. And so it's important for me that people know the games that corporations play, the games that leaders play. One of the things we're going to talk about soon is this idea of performance improvement plans, right? So we all know the performance improvement plan is usually just the hospice for your career, right? Once you get on a PIP, there is usually limited to no intention on getting you off of it. It's really the death wish, the kiss of death. And so how do we help you navigate, one, not getting there, but if you do get there, there is a way to get off of it. There's a way to recover from it, but you have to really be intentional about it. And so we share and go behind the curtain on the things that we've seen to help you realize, like, it doesn't have to be a victim situation and that you're not alone. We've got a Facebook following. We've got all of the channels, and we're excited about the impact we've been able to make. 3 months in, we've got, I don't know, 8 different countries and several. The season is all about HR. So excited to see where this is going. And everyone I talked to, like, yeah, I want to be on. So HD, you're going to have to come on and talk to us about your bad boss stories. I'm sure you got a few.
Yeah, for sure. I honestly, you know what? Now I think about it, really only, if I real deal think about it, maybe only one. Like one is like, I don't feel like they were bad. I just feel like they didn't care. I didn't really have anything where it's like they would tell me anything, like some stuff you said, they would just lie. I remember when I used to work for, now it's GDIT, but it was CSRA at the time. And I was trying to move to different roles in the company. And pretty much they wanted me to stay on the help desk, but they were acting like they didn't know I was interviewing. And the recruiter, I was cool with her. She was like, yeah, they stopped your interview because of the OPM breach, which is fine. But when I asked them about it, they was like, oh no, I don't know anything about that. So that was the time. So I was like, okay, I got to leave. Cause something happened. I think I was really ready to do a different role and they asked it. And so all I could think about while sitting at my desk was the scene where the teacher, only on me, went in to the office and flipped that man's desk over. But I was like, I got bills. So that's the only reason I ain't do it, because I was hot, because I was like, there's no way. I get I'm one of your best agents, but you guys keep on nixing me from leaving, but you don't want to give me any more money. So that was like my biggest issue. I was like, it'd be different if you said, hey, we want you to stay, so we're going to give you a raise. No raise. We found out that other people in the building were getting bonuses, but I was like, our contract was probably the primary reason why the new building got built. But I was like, so I just started seeing how we were getting mistreated. I was like, y'all can stay here because y'all happy that this is Shreveport and y'all making above average money for here, but not me. So I was like, I had to skedaddle. And that's what I did.
But see, that literally is the example of companies being the bad boyfriend. We want you where we want you. And I don't care what your aspirations are, what your dreams are, what you're capable of. Like, I just need you here. And more often than not, the reason why that's bad and that exists because you don't get any visibility beyond your direct management. So I would tell your folks, y'all, go find other people. Figure out other people in other functions who know your greatness so that they can be the ones talking about you when you're in the room. Because if it's only your manager, most managers don't get incentivized for making good talent better. They don't. And so they're not getting a bonus if you get another job. What they'll have is a hole, and they end up basically entrapping you because they need you for their own bonus sake. And so it's really toxic. I'm telling you, it's the system's broken. But yeah.
Like one guy was able to lead the help desk like a thief in the night because some type of way, the other boss really wanted him bad, and they snatched him up. That like they, he just, I don't know how he did. I was so mad. I was very envious. I was like, ain't no way. I've been here for pretty much 2 years, and you got here, and you got to get your way. That's actually making me salty now that I'm thinking about all the stuff they were wrong. Because truth be told, I never had any intention to move to Dallas, Texas. Like, I had no intention to. I wanted to stay home. And I said, okay, cool. I found a company, got a job, I got my degree. I'm going to try to move up the ranks. And I found out, like, I was living in a fairy tale world. So, I can go more in detail on the show.
I've seen all of it, and I really want to hear more because there's just a lot. There's a lot of that happens.
Oh yeah, between that and getting laid off of my first security role, or them hiring people that weren't even qualified to even lead our team, yeah, a lot. Or I've had like all this stuff is like documented. Like on, I have a series of the podcast where it's like my cybersecurity career journey, and like I have various episodes where it's just been solo episodes where I've discussed like from help desk all the way to getting laid off to. Things I experienced by getting laid off. I had a job one time say, hey, you're the most qualified. We're going to pass. I'm like, what? How are you going to pass on the person that's the most qualified? It was like, it was a whole bunch of crazy stuff that was going on. I was like, okay. It was, but I ended up getting to the company that I needed to be at. So that was like the pro out of that whole thing. It was like, where I needed to be, I got to. But it just sucks when you're going through it.
That's the point. You said that it sucks when you're going through it. So we want to try to help it suck less. But also, I think you, to know when you should raise cane and flip over a table versus when, you know, you hold your cards and keep it moving. Because there is a difference of between when. And a lot of folks aren't self-actualized to know which they should do and when. So wait a minute. You said you were going to talk about parenting. You wanted to know about.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I'm glad you brought that up. Okay. So I'm mad that. Some of the things we talked about when we talked about people being fired, then we talked about people who should be managers and shouldn't, just because you're good at your job doesn't mean you should be managing people.
We do need to talk about that.
But I know we were also going to talk about, I was going to ask you about, have you felt you have more grace with people now dealing with a child that's on a spectrum? Because I feel like I have a lot more grace and just... looking at people, how they present themselves, how they talk, are they stemming, are they not? I'm listening for a whole bunch of different things now when I'm dealing with people to figure out how I should handle them. As well as, like I always tell everybody, one of the best books I read for my career was in my grad school doing that emotional intelligence class. But when the class on emotional intelligence, we had a book on emotional intelligence that I've utilized for about 7 years.
The Dan Goldman book?
I got to find it somewhere over there. It's like a little white and orange emotional intelligence 2.0, I think, something like that.
I think I have that somewhere over here.
But yeah, like that book really, I tell everybody, like everyone should do a course on emotional intelligence. I think people will be able to work better because you can tell who knows it and you can tell who has a low EQ.
For sure. For sure. So yeah, we have 2 children. One is 9, the other one is 6. Our son is 9, our daughter 6. My daughter is neurotypical, meaning that she's just the average kid in terms of the developmental curve. And my son's neurodiverse. He has autism. And I knew that he had autism. I knew at 2 that there was something different. He said Alexa before he said mom. Because it was just the weirdest thing. And he had just a lot of different idiosyncratic behaviors from repeating things to he had an obsession with the washing machine. He could hear when the washing machine was broken. He said, mom, something's wrong with the washing machine because it does. Instead of, like he just has such an intricate mind. And when he was diagnosed at 6, after lots and lots of advocating to get him tested, which is a whole nother thing. It took the wind out of my sails because I don't know what to do with this. And then I just dug in of like, how do we go forward? How do we get to know? How do we understand? And I've learned that my entire job as his mother to help him be as successful as he can be in the world is to try to see the world through his eyes. And so every day I'm asking questions, I'm looking at him, I'm trying to see what he sees, and he's verbal, he's self-aware, he can do all of the things. So we're blessed in that way. And there are times I'm like, I don't understand what you're saying. So there's a lot of language challenges that we have in terms of he can speak, but the words he uses aren't the same that we would use. And it's cool that he makes up words, which is cool. So he likes wash machines. We bought him a salad spinner because he just wanted to see something spin around because that's like his stimming thing. And my husband's like, are you sure? I'm like, yeah, it's noisy, but he likes it. And I'm like, I tried to call it a salad spinner, but somehow he calls it the spinnerator. Okay, the spinnerator. And I just adopt the name of the spinnerator. He puts the wash. What? The spinner. He should. I said all that to say that I have learned and I'm still learning to listen more. Like I've been coaching for 15 years. I got certified the first time. But about 15 years ago. And then the second time, it's about 12 years ago. I've been coaching for a long time. In coaching, they teach you how to listen and to ask questions and to hear what's not being said. And I want to believe I'm really good at that. And I also now listen in a different way when people are saying things. I listen in a different way when they're explaining. I know for a fact in my very last job, I had to coach a neurodiverse leader who didn't know he was neurodiverse. And he wanted to fire someone who was neurodiverse because he couldn't handle it. And it was such a painful thing for me because I could tell that the employee didn't know what was wrong. And the manager was so adamant and so agitated and so emotionally overwhelmed that it looked like he was short-circuiting. And it was an IT, right? So here we are. So, okay, I'm doing this. I'm so sick of him and I don't know what to do. I'm like, but I don't think you've ever told him. If you're talking to me the way you're talking to him, there's no possible way he knows how to be successful with you. And he's like, I don't care, Nellie. I gotta get rid of him. I'm just done. And when we got ready to do the termination, the manager didn't want to come on camera, but I made him. And he saw this other guy sitting in his home working. He's an IT guy. And he's like, okay, this is the end of the road for you. This is not working. And just the confusion on this other person's face was just so profound. And the lack of compassion on the other side, my heart broke in so many different ways because I understood what was happening. And neither one of them, at least one out of two of them for sure, there was no way for me to articulate, there's something here and you need to go think about it. And there's so many undiagnosed people. That's another thing. So I can tell, and I'm like, oh, I'm not allowed to diagnose you, but now I know how to talk to you. Now I know how to ask questions. Now I know how to listen. And I'd say, yes, it's given me a ton more grace, a ton more patience. Let me be very clear. I've not been this patient. Part of this is age, but I think part of this is wisdom and experience. But part of this is just having a child that requires a different part of me. And I think more people need to be aware of this. So in 2000, there was 1 in 100 autistic kids. Every kid. So one autistic kid for every 100. Now that's 1 in 36. And so we're going to continue to see in the workforce where there is a need for more HDs and Natalies to be able to translate, to advocate, to help and support the plethora of neurodiverse kids and people that will be in the workforce. It's not a question of if, it's when. And if the managers aren't managing now, how will they manage in 5, 10 years? When the number is 25 to 30% of the workforce is going to be neurodiverse.
Yeah, no. Oh, so true. I know you were talking about his fixation. We knew pretty early in that we had that kind of back and forth about, I'm like, we should go get her checked or whatever. And it took forever, but we finally got to the neurologist around, what was she? Was it before she was 4? I think she was like 3 or something. So it was pretty early on because I got a lot of family, got younger siblings, so it's bad to do a lot of comparisons, but it's good if I have something to draw from when I'm knowing things a kid should do. And people liking a lot of stuff, the vaccines, I don't know how provable it is. I do feel like they try to do overkill with the vaccines for the kids when trying to give them 4 and 5 shots at a time. I think that's too much. But Natalie's thing has always been, we start seeing like all the different things like on TikTok with what people's autistic kids would do. So Natalie's thing was the line stuff up, whether the cars and line them up by color or whatever. Like she's going to line some stuff up or play with something a certain way that might not be supposed to be played that way or whatever. And she can get fixated on something, whatever, or she has to fit in something. Or the problem.
The transitions.
Transitions are big. So we got that in the IEP for sure. We got that for sure in there. But no, it's, I mean, it's a lot of stuff. Like I said, I remember our first conversation and we were like, then we start playing the game. Who she got this from? I think I do that. I think she did that. But now you're trying to figure out, okay, let me see if I can do that. Because when you were talking about the guy getting laid off or really fired, I was like, even though companies are like most like at-will states and stuff like that, there needs to be some type of, I don't know if it's firing compliance, but it needs to be some type of way to say, hey, is this person unsatisfactory? Is this, did they do these things that could legitimize them being fired versus have you told them that? Because by nature, me being in tech these years, she hates it. But I'm saying, hey, I need you to be specific with me and what you want me to do, not what you think I should do based on what's in here. Just tell me what you want me to do. And she hates that. Why should I have to tell you that you should know? I'm like, but I don't know what you're thinking. And so by nature, a lot of people are like, hey, specifically just tell me what you want me to do and we can do it. But if you think I should know what you want me to do, I don't know, then hey. Now, sometimes the issues is people will sit around at work and never ask, hey, what am I supposed to do? And so a leader will get mad at them. So that's an issue sometimes that I run into. But as a leader, you have to set the tone and say, okay, this is what you got to do. That. And I'm reminded of when I used to work retail at Target, where I had some good leaders. So we had I did hard lines and the manager would say, okay, that person's lazy, but they are very good with bedding and folding up stuff in domestics. Hey, you doing domestics. You know what? Y'all two work toys. Y'all two go work seasonal because they were spreading us out based on what we were more effective in. And a lot of managers mm-hmm. don't do that. They treat everybody the same. And that's why their teams aren't as good.
No, I agree. I want to go back to something that you said and give an example. So one of the traits of being autistic is very literal, very literal conversation, right? So you can't use alliterations or analogies or metaphors, right? To say something is like, it's raining cats and dogs. They will go look outside to look for the cats and dogs. One time I was folding we were doing something in the kitchen. I said, Nathan, go put this underneath the sink. Underneath our sink, like most sinks, you open the cabinet and there's things, right? We have a vent underneath the cabinet and the vent cover came off. And so my vent, I think he was like 5 years old, my child was trying to put the thing in the vent because he was looking underneath the sink because that's technically the bottom part underneath the sink. And it's those kinds of things that also help me learn that I'm not the best at communicating to, right? And I think I'm decent. It's been an interesting journey for those kinds of things. So, okay, I need to understand. I've also learned how to read energy better, where when he's overwhelmed or overstimulated, being able to communicate and he's gotten better, say, I need a break. True story. Our daughter was graduating from pre-K and we were all excited. The whole family was going and he had just gotten off the bus. And I had told him the day before, okay, we're about to go to your sister's graduation. And he was like, okay, fine. We get there and he scouts out the place and he's like, I need to go somewhere else. I was like, no, just sit down. And he starts to get real agitated before the thing starts. He said, it's going to be loud. I said, it's okay. He's like, no, when they clap, it's going to be loud. And I'm like, you're fine. And when they started clapping, he broke down in tears. And I was like, I felt so bad because he was trying to articulate that he had enough of the day that he couldn't do this too. And I was so interested in making sure that the moment was good for my daughter that I wasn't reading his signals and he was trying to articulate it. So I've learned and he's learned how to articulate now better, but we're also learning he's done. We can't go do this extra thing. We've got to manage our time and manage his energy. And I think if more people knew that about themselves, it would also make for better workplaces of knowing when you're overwhelmed and overstimulated and can't listen anymore or can't take anymore. Of saying, okay, I need a break, and giving people the grace to do the same.
Now, ironically, right before we started recording, Natalie was supposed to do some cleanup, but she didn't want to clean up, whatever. And after that, she was upset. Right? I said, okay, me and her mom start laughing. Go take your break. We just let her have it. But now this could definitely turn into a whole new, which I feel like they got some podcasts out there, like with parents that have neurodivergent kids out there, just because people just want to feel connected. And Sometimes some places you don't have a big family to support you. So you just want to feel a part of something and know, hey, what you're going through, everybody else is going through maybe in their own different way, but you have some people that don't want the best for you and your kids' outcome.
Yeah.
But Natalie, how can the listeners keep up with you?
Oh, yeah. They can go to my website, thenatalieparker.com, thenatalieparker.com, N-A-T-A-L-I-E, Parker, P-A-R-K-E-R.com. We also have a website for the podcast, yourbosssucks.com. I'm also on LinkedIn. You can find me there, and Facebook for both the company and the podcast, Instagram and TikTok. So we're on all the things.
Perfect. Guys, like I always say, until next time, let's stay textual, and we out. Peace.